The Drug Enforcement Agency has confiscated 17 pounds of the synthetic opioid fentanyl in Northern California during the last 8 months or so. At 2 milligrams per lethal dose, those 17 pounds are sufficient to kill 37 million people. This leads us to ask, who wants to see us dead?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1291st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Kowloon who are tuned into the podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, between 1839 and 1860, China's Qing Dynasty fought two wars against Western powers. The first was against Great Britain, the second with Great Britain and France. The reason for the wars was opium. The Western powers wanted to sell opium to China, while the Qing Dynasty did not want them to sell the opium. These wars would go down in history as the Opium Wars. In both wars, modern military technologies enabled the Western powers to roll over the Qing, compelling it to grant favorable tariffs, trade concessions, reparations, and territory to the invading powers, including the port of Hong Kong. The victory by the West also crushed all hope that the Qing had for controlling the nation's consumption of opium, and by the 1890s, China had an estimated 15 million opium addicts. One would think that a nation with 9,000 years of history would have a long memory, and so it is likely that the Chinese have not forgotten the humiliation the nation suffered at the hands of the West during those opium wars. Today, it is the West that is suffering the humiliation of addiction. Only now, the addiction is to heroin, which is far more potent than opium, and to fentanyl, which is 30 to 50 times more potent than heroin, and to carfentanil, which is 5,000 times more potent than heroin, and 10,000 times more potent than morphine. These derivatives of the opium poppy and our addiction to them lead us to ask, who wants to see us dead? Here to help us see what is happening on the streets of our nation's cities, we have Dr. Daniel Ciccaroni, who is professor of family and community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Daniel, welcome to the Food Chain.
Pleasure to be here, Michael.
Doctor or teacher, or doctor and teacher?
I am a professor, so I wear three hats. I'm a researcher and a teacher and a clinician in addiction medicine.
So how do all three of you work together?
You know, that's a great question, Michael. You know, there used to be a time where we didn't work well together, but within the last 5 years or so, I've aligned everything under the theme of addiction medicine. So my research is about addiction, my clinic is about addiction, and my teaching is helping the young doctors and other health professionals understand this disease we call addiction.
And in doing all, you're helping the rest of us try to figure out what on earth is happening to us here, because it seems like things are kind of spooling out of control. Am I wrong?
Well, I'd like to think that I'm helping, one. And two is I have described the current conditions as a crisis, and I'm very careful about the words, as an academic, about the words that I use. So we could call this an epidemic, which basically says that there's a higher number of people who are afflicted, or in this case, are dying. But I call it a crisis because not only is it an epidemic, that is rising numbers, but it's also, we also have the sense that it's out of control and that we don't fully understand what to do about it. And hence, you know, we're in a 20-year epidemic of rising deaths due to the class of drugs called the opioids, and we don't have control of it yet. It continues to rise to this minute.
I actually saw just this morning another post on the news feeds about how the opioid epidemic has not slowed down in the least bit.
No, it's COVID accelerated it, unfortunately. But it was rising steadily in the year, several years prior to COVID. But COVID was an accelerant. We understand now that mental health issues rose, suicidality rose, use of common drugs, for example, alcohol, rose during COVID, and also illicits as well, including heroin and fentanyl.
Well, then what does the professor and the doctor and the teacher see when he walks the streets of San Francisco?
Well, I walk the streets of a number of communities in the United States. My research is national. I've been to large cities like Baltimore and small cities like Nashua, New Hampshire. I do spend time in San Francisco when COVID allows me to. What I'm seeing now is the unfortunate breach of what seemed to be of fentanyl not coming to the western part of the United States. It seemed to stay east of the Mississippi River and harm the folks that live in the Midwest, down to Appalachia, over to the Mid-Atlantic, up to New England. That was sort of its zone. But unfortunately, that got breached a couple of years ago, and now fentanyl is an unfortunately a popular drug in San Francisco and to some degree other parts of the western United States.
Well, we see in the DEA seizure statistics that in 2015, there were no seizures of fentanyl in Northern California. And now we're up to, 17 pounds of fentanyl, which is said to be enough to kill 37 million people. Is that true? 37 million? How lethal is this stuff?
Let's stay away from that number for a moment, because 37 million people will not die of fentanyl anytime soon. I can put money on that. But thousands will die in the next year. We know that, for example, in the last 12 months of Centers for Disease Control, that's the CDC data, that 95,000 Americans died of drug poisoning. Of those 95,000, about 70,000 were due to the opioids, and the overwhelming majority of those deaths were due to the fentanyls. So probably about somewhere around 50, low 50s, thousands of people died of fentanyl last year. We have to have a little bit of history here, and I love your opening around the opium wars and about how power and money influenced the drug trade, the illicit drug trade. Actually, probably the illicit drug trade as well.
there you go.
But that's a separate conversation. So we have to understand that fentanyl started as a East Coast, Midwest phenomenon around 2014. And in there, it started as a contamination of the heroin supply. So if you weren't a heroin user, it was unlikely you were going to get exposed to fentanyl.
Didn't they call it a poisoning epidemic?
Oh, that's my phrase. I mean, I'm the one who coined that and said that.
You called it that then. Very good. And what did you mean by that?
What I meant by that was that the you didn't go to the corner of the street corner and say, oh, can I have some of that fentanyl? What you went for is you bought heroin, and unbeknownst to you and probably to the street-level dealer who was slinging it, you got, to some degree, fentanyl. It could have been all fentanyl. It could have been a mixture of heroin and fentanyl. It could have been heroin. It could have been a good day. Because a lot of time, people in 2014, 2015, 2016 on the East Coast, when you ask them, do you want the fentanyl? They would say no. Believe it or not. I know it's hard for people to kind of wrap their heads around that, because we somehow have this stereotype or this notion that folks that use drugs are always seeking like the most potent, the most powerful. But the truth is, and our research showed this, that people were trying to avoid the fentanyl because they knew it was too strong, right? They wanted good old-fashioned heroin, but they couldn't get it because all of a sudden the stream of heroin was partially to fully contaminated, or as I call it, a poisoning crisis, because it was killing people. And folks realized this. They realized that their friends and their lovers and their family members were dying of this contaminated heroin. And those of us who have, you know, long experience in this field said, well, hopefully this is just a flash in the pan. It's happened before. We've had these little fentanyl outbreaks. They go away in 6 months. Well, this one didn't go away, right? And then it went and grabbed another state and another state and another state, and it just grew. It just mushroomed out from its origins, which was probably, you know, the Chicago area, mushroomed out to take over that whole region that I talked about before. And now, as of 2018, it's mushroomed out to the rest of the United States, including the western half.
And is is there a way to avoid it?
There is. Folks like myself and others have been championing this notion. It's a European notion. We're just sort of borrowing it, of drug checking. And so if you recognize for a moment that at any given day, a person who uses, let's say, heroin is not ready for treatment. They might be ready tomorrow, and we should have open doors. We should have, you know, policies that allow people, and we can talk about that later, about what kind of policies would help the situation. But if we recognize at any given day that somebody who has an addiction simply wants to address their needs for that day, we can make the drug supply safer. And one thing that has been rolled out is this notion of fentanyl test strips. So if somebody wants to try to avoid fentanyl, easier on the West Coast than it is on the East Coast, but you could take 60 seconds to test your, actually a couple minutes really, to test your heroin or your meth or your cocaine, because some of those drugs are contaminated, again, poisoning crisis, with fentanyl. And then you can make a choice if it comes back positive. You could throw it away. You could do a smaller amount of it just to see how it feels in your body, et cetera. Drug checking could also be taken to a large level, so a municipality could test all of the drugs that were seized in the week before. We do this all the time because due to arrests and stuff like that, and test that. And we published a paper in Ohio showing that if you test drugs on a regular basis, you actually have a kind of an early warning system. You can tell people, like, whoop, guess what, folks? Carfentanil just showed up, and
something's
happening.
Stay away. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today, we're talking with Dr. Daniel Ciccarone, who is a professor of family community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He is a professor, a doctor, and a teacher. And today, he's serving as all three of those in the job of teaching us what's going on the streets of our cities. Right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And Dr. Daniel Ciccaroni, and the subject is the fentanyl and the heroin and everything else that is being consumed on the streets of our cities. Quick question, Doctor, why put fentanyl in heroin and cocaine and whatever else they're putting it in?
Yeah, so Michael, that's actually the million-dollar question. If you put 10 or 25 folks like me in a room, we'd have a rousing conversation about why fentanyl question. So there's no consensus answer, but I'll give you the range of answers. So the range of answers includes the fact that a new drug producer came along, right? When we think about drug producing countries, and we have to remember not to blame the whole country. It's rogue elements within the country. Sure. You can call them cartels, you can call them drug trafficking organizations, etc. We think about elements within Colombia, we think of elements within Mexico, we think of Afghanistan perhaps, but we don't think China, right? And China's become a big player in the U.S. illicit drug market. And its biggest play to date has been fentanyl. And it's not just fentanyl. They've produced, for example, precursors that get turned into methamphetamine. They are the number one producer of the chemicals that go into making illicit methamphetamine, whether it's made in the U.S. or made in Mexico, is the secondary level. But they make the majority of the fentanyl that comes to the United States. Mexico produces some. There may be some other elements that are producing some, certainly in Europe, but that doesn't make it to the United States. So we don't think that China is this sort of rogue country producing a big part of our illicit drug supply, but they are. They say they're taking care of it. They've outlawed it. They're trying to regulate, and screen and all that stuff. But they have not been successful in doing so because the flows only get bigger. Now, another thing we have to keep in mind, Michael, is that when we say, oh, there's been a large bust, right, or that seizures have gone up, right, it sounds like good news, and it is good news, right? We should take the drugs off the street. But in drug policy, we just use that as a marker for the size of the flow. So, for example, if we say the seizures are up 2019 to 2020, right, what that says to me is that the flow of that illicit good went up. Right, the seizure rate remains about constant, around 10 to 15% of the drug supply, and the streets benefit by taking that 10 to 15% off. Right, but 85% gets through, seizures are good, but they're also just a marker for increased supply.
Kind of an indicator of what's going on.
You got it.
So, I open this show with a discussion of the opium wars. Are we back there? Are we on the receiving end instead of the giving end?
Well, it's a terrific metaphor for sure. The geopolitics of U.S.-China relationships are really fraught right now with a bona fide trade war during the last administration and a number of tense issues and topics that continue into the current administration. This is just one of them, right? This is just one element. Now, the Chinese authorities, if we take them for their word, they're trying to curtail the trade. And my colleague Bryce Pardo at RAND would say that they don't have the regulatory capacity to live up to their laws. So if the law in China says that the whole class of fentanyls is banned from production, right, so especially anything that's not meant for the pharmaceutical world. That's one way. The question is then, do they have the regulatory capacity, like our FDA or our DEA, to go and put that law into effect? And he argues that they don't, even though they're big and they have a bit of a state control kind of mentality. They actually don't have the level of control they would need to go suss out. And here's the reason why. The reason why is that fentanyl is very powerful in small volumes. So you would say 17 pounds. If we were talking about 17 pounds of marijuana, right, nobody would blink an eye at that. They'd be like, 17 pounds of marijuana, what's the big deal, right?
Backyard.
If you, If you were to say 17 pounds of cocaine, people say, oh, that's a small bust. Thank you for doing that, you know, blah, blah, blah. 17 pounds of fentanyl, of course, is a huge amount, right? Like you said, it kills tens of millions of people, potentially. It's not going to, but it could. And that's because it's potent, right? And so we're talking about small production, small illicit labs in China, and they don't have the regulatory capacity. So getting back to an earlier question, that was one reason why that's Dr. Pardo's favorite reason as to why fentanyl is because we have a new source country and they don't have the regulatory capacity to control their illicit elements.
So that reason would be China.
Right. And mine has to do with the geopolitics of Latin America. Right. And we have gotten all of our heroin from two countries in Latin America. And your audience probably knows this already, but those elements would be within Colombia and within Mexico. They have been so powerful in supplying us heroin and other drugs. You know, Mexican cartels are involved in the cocaine trade. They're involved in the marijuana trade, the methamphetamine trade, et cetera. That they control the U.S. retail market. We actually do not get any heroin from Afghanistan. We have not gotten any heroin from Southeast Asia. I think the Burma, Lao, Thai, Golden Triangle. We haven't gotten from decades. We haven't gotten any heroin from that area for decades. We get it from Mexico and Colombia, right?
So they control the market.
They control the U.S. retail market, right? Okay. Or wholesale to retail market. And it's too long an answer to give, but the hypothesis that I've been working on is that they simply don't have enough, believe it or not, they don't have enough between the two of them, poppy leading to opium, leading to heroin, to supply American need. So my hypothesis, which is not, again, not consensus, is that fentanyl comes along as a substitute because the natural crop cannot feed American demand.
And with something so potent in such small quantities, you can take the opium or the heroin that you do have and extend it to much greater populations and much greater markets then.
Thank you, Michael. That's exactly what I call it. I call it the extender hypothesis. And Colombia is pulling out of the heroin business. They supplied most of U.S. heroin for more than a decade, drove prices way down because they had a very cheap and potent product. But they pulled out. And the Mexican cartels have taken over, but they are taking over turf that they're unfamiliar with, which is, ding, 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 the East Coast. And the fentanyl came along at the same time as that geopolitical shift in our heroin supply.
Now, who runs the, the opioid business on the East Coast? The Mexicans and Colombians here on the West Coast, but who does it on the East Coast?
Well, we're talking U.S.-wide. So on the East Coast, it used to be the Colombians, right? Both cocaine and heroin, with some help from Dominican and Puerto Rican and Mexican elements. And again, not to blame any particular ethnic group. It's just, you know, the elements within that group.
Sure.
But the Colombians are out. They pulled out. They literally just, and nobody realizes this. Nobody, you know, I know it because I read everything.
Sure. Did they pull out or did they get run out?
That's always a good question. In this case, it seemed to be peaceful. It seemed to me they just gave up. They pulled back and decided that cocaine worldwide was much more profitable and worthy of holding on to, and that heroin just going to the U.S. was not enough business for them. So they just gave it over to the Mexicans. That's a summary of a lot of, you know, data from DEA and the U.N. and stuff like that. And we're not necessarily in agreement on, again, my colleagues, you put a bunch of us in the room, you know, there'll be people shouting at me right now.
There you go.
So take that as a controversial hypothesis.
So there's two good possible reasons. One's China, and the other is a product extender for South America. Any other hypotheses?
Sort of in the interstices between those two would be the idea that heroin as a geopolitical product is problematic, right? It's dependent on weather and crops and borders and control of land.
Sunshine and fresh air and yeah.
Yeah, and so we know. I mean, the end game is that the world becomes increasingly democratic and becomes increasingly liberalized in its economics, sharing goods and services, and doesn't tolerate the opium trade. And so, for example, our best example thus far is the Golden Triangle, right? The Golden Triangle has essentially gone out of business. Why? Because of economic and political development of Southeast Asia, of which, you know, the hangers-on of old regimes and old politics couldn't stay. You know, Thailand became successful economically, and all of its neighbors, including Burma and Laos, to some degree, have followed along, and so they don't tolerate the illicit opium to heroin trade anymore. And so it used to be the biggest player on the world scene. Think about, you know, the 1970s. And it's a very tiny player now compared to Afghanistan and you know, the Latin America. And so people in other parts of the world are thinking that, you know, at some point their game is going to be up too, right? That they're not going to be able to have land that's not under government control in Colombia or Mexico to grow crops. And so they brought it to the lab. The lab is more concealable. It's again a smaller volume of a more potent substance. It's a bit more out of reach of regulatory control.
Let's talk a little bit about fentanyl and carfentanil as well. I guess it's the same kind of thing. Do those products actually need opium? Do you need the poppy to make those products?
So you don't, right? So we're going to basics here, where we have to understand that there's three ways to make an opioid that that a human might consume, or not in the case of carfentanil, not a human, another animal. You have the products that come straight out of the poppy plant, you know, through processing, of course, but morphine and codeine, for example, are natural opioids. That's one subclass of opioids. The second are what we call the semi-synthetics, and that is they have some relationship to the poppy plant and opium, but are derivatives. So things like oxycodone or hydromorphone are pharmaceuticals that we use. They're very powerful. They're very useful. We use them to treat pain, and they're derived from poppy material, but they're semi-synthetic. And then you have the synthetics that have nothing to do with the poppy plant or opium. Fentanyl and methadone are the two that, you know, most common, and they are produced in pharmaceutical labs.
So in essence, then, you could be making a bathtub full of fentanyl without any in your bathroom, without any connection to the outside world, if you have the right precursors, the right chemicals to start with.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that easy. We certainly have that metaphor for meth, the chemical synthesis of methamphetamine from precursors like pseudoephedrine is relatively easy, and one actually could do it in their bathtub. Fentanyl is probably a little bit more complex than that. But yes, it could be done small scale, which always means more clandestine.
Right.
So one can do it in the back corner of some huge industrial facility in China, and it could go on undetected.
And let's talk a little bit about the potency, because I briefly brought up the notion that 17 pounds of fentanyl is enough to kill 37 million people. So that's extraordinarily powerful stuff.
So you put in those sort of the data on the ratios. Right? You know, the fentanyl is 100 times as potent as morphine by weight, and it's probably 20 to 40 times as potent as heroin by weight, heroin being more potent than morphine. So another way to look at it is that for somebody who's sort of the average consumer of heroin, they're going to consume something that anyone who takes a pharmaceutical would recognize as a dose. They're going to take milligrams, right? And milligrams are not a lot, right? Milligrams are a thousandth of a gram, a very small amount. But people know they take blood pressure medicine, it's 25 milligrams, right? They recognize that sort of unit of measure. Fentanyl is in micrograms, right? So if I use it, if I'm an anesthesiologist and I'm using it during surgery, I'm giving someone micrograms of fentanyl, which is tiny dosing. If you would actually to dry it and put it on a piece of paper, you would barely see micrograms of a material. And so its range of dosing or its range of safe dosing is pretty narrow. 100 micrograms of fentanyl might make someone feel good, might make someone feel high, might make someone feel out of pain. Whereas if we got closer to hundreds of micrograms or even close to 1 milligram, we're getting to potential lethality. And certainly by the time you get to 2 milligrams of fentanyl, you pretty much have a lethal dose. So I think that's where they're calculating the pounds to deadliness there, is saying that it's how many 2 milligram doses of fentanyl are in that batch.
And what about carfentanil?
So then we have to recognize that fentanyl is also a class, it's a subclass of opioids, yes, but it's a class in and of itself, and that it has, because of its chemical structure, it has 600 potential cousins, of which there are about 200 that have been made already. So there's 200 chemical cousins, we call them analogs. So there's 200 fentanyl analogs out in the world. Some of them are more potent than fentanyl, meaning more deadly, more problematic. And those are, if you look at the word, how it's spelled, those are the ILs, carfentanil, IL, alfentanil, surfentanil, remifentanil. These are of a subclass of fentanyls that are just super potent. They're really not meant for human consumption. They're meant for you to be able to give a small shot of medication to an elephant. And I'm not joking. That sounds like a joke, but I'm not joking. They are veterinary-level medicines to relieve pain, because elephants also need surgery, right? And remifentanil has been used as a terrorist agent, right? Chechen bombing, et cetera. So they're just super potent. They are in the human supply chain, they are utter poisons. There's no safe way to use carfentanil. Everywhere fentanyl appears in the U.S. market, it leads to a wave of death.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, we are talking about fentanyl with Dr. Daniel Ciccaroni, who's a professor of family community medicine at University of California, San Francisco, trying to figure out who out there wants to see us dead with this stuff. Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. Metro Farm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it's a pretty sad situation. If you walk down the streets of just about any big city, what you're seeing now is very sad. Is there any hope in what you see, Dr. Ciccaroni?
Well, I am by nature an optimistic person. And, you know, even though despite being in a fentanyl epidemic or fentanyl crisis for almost 7 years now, I do see its end. Drugs that are super deadly, they just don't last. I mean, whether it's through the crass mechanism of people dying or the next generation that just rejects it, right? The next generation comes along and says, why would I do that? And they do something different, right? They take on a different. So we do see over time drug cycle, right? The drug of the moment, and anyone who's of a certain age can recall just in their lived experience on the planet, we had a crack thing, and we had a meth thing, and then we had a heroin thing, and then a pill thing, and now we're doing the fentanyl thing. They know that these things cycle. So I do expect fentanyl to cycle out, believe it or not. But what I also see, just to answer your question, is I see a lot of attention being given. I do see government policies changing because it's a crisis, and because it's, frankly, it's affected a lot of white middle-class folks, and so it's not just the stereotype of the inner-city minority, right? It's affecting, and it's a racist sort of change in politics.
It's everybody's children.
But it's everybody's children now, right? It is white and black and Latino, and it's urban and rural. And suburban, right? So we are seeing attention to it. And frankly, I'm seeing the politics change around it. The last administration had ample opportunity to work on this, and they made some changes, which were good. The current administration is taking it even more seriously in terms of the policies that need to change. And so I do see that happening. I see a lot of good work in every community that I go to, people ramping up treatment, people ramping up harm reduction, and we can talk about all of those things, but I do see change happening. We're going to see money from the opioid settlements, right, from the mass litigation against opioid manufacturers and distributors, and that money is going to go back to communities to do good, at least if my crystal ball is correct on that.
There you go. Now, one of the things that I've noticed is that there seems to be an association between the opioids and the stimulant markets. You know, we seem to like stimulants. Makes everybody feel good for a minute or two. So we go for the uppers, the cocaine, the methamphetamines. But how do opioids fit into that marketplace?
Yeah, it's a good question, Michael. So it fits along with my metaphor of drug cycling, right? We seem to be now, the new drug has already declared itself, or the new class of drugs, the stimulants, right? That would include cocaine and what the CDC call psychostimulants, which were the major one of which is methamphetamine. Use of cocaine and methamphetamine is on the upswing. And to some degree, and the way it's connected to the opioid phenomena, what I call the triple wave phenomena of overdoses due to pills, then segueing to heroin, then segueing to fentanyl. Methamphetamine overdoses are a fourth wave in this overdose crisis because people are combining the two. Folks, we know polydrug use is a phenomena that happens, but we are in a historic wave of people combining drugs. And the main combination right now out there in the world is stimulants plus a high-potency opioid like heroin or fentanyl.
So to take you way up and bring you way down.
Well, some people are doing it that way. Some people are doing it kind of functionally, like I use the meth to get up because I have a job to go to, and I use, you know, heroin or fentanyl to relax. And some people are combining the two. And here's an interesting thing historically. This combination of methamphetamine and heroin historically was called a goofball. And it was called a goofball for a reason, in that it was a kind of a weird thing to do. It wasn't popular. It wasn't a likable combination. The combination of heroin and cocaine was very likable. That was called a speedball. It was important to people. Historically common, right? But the goofball was never historically common. But the goofball is back, and it's back because methamphetamine has finally met its mate, and that is fentanyl. Fentanyl is strong enough to meet up with the potency of methamphetamine. America gets unbelievably cheap and pure methamphetamine into its borders. That's a whole different hour, Michael. Mm-hmm. And that cheap and pure methamphetamine has met its mate, which is cheap and potent fentanyl.
So, wow. With respect to putting a stop to all, you know, you'll look back to the opium wars. And the opium wars made possible this incredible addiction in China that lasted almost into the 1900s. And it was only the outrage of the world citizens that, you know, said, we can't do this anymore. This is as bad as slavery, that what we're doing to China. And it was, so it was a public opinion that really forced, you know, the Western powers to back off and stop selling opium to China. Although the addiction probably went on for a long, long time after that. So how do we marshal our forces to stop this?
Yeah, so on the supply side, we're working on, not we including me, but we, the people who are in charge of this at the governmental level, are working on high-level agreements with the Chinese government for technical assistance, right? And so we have our experts in supply control, which would include the Drug Enforcement Administration, the USDEA, working with their equivalents in China. And so I'm hoping that something comes out of that some sort of regulatory support can help curtail on the supply side. I'm not utterly optimistic, because I do realize that when it comes to capitalism and it comes to the profitability of these drugs, that where there's a will, there's a way, right? And so we have seen over the last 30 years nothing but cheaper and more potent drugs on the U.S. streets, despite all of our efforts at supply control. But that's the supply side answer. On the demand side...
But before we move on, what about India? Because India is a big pharmaceutical nation as well. Are we getting...
That's a great question. In fact, when this first hit, and I was talking to just a handful of people who were like me in terms of, like, where in the world is this fentanyl coming from? And I said, there's only two places that could do it. And one is China and the other is India, that could produce this much fentanyl for American consumption. And it just happened to be China. India is another possibility. It's not happening, fortunately. I think there's greater concern that if for some reason the Chinese market was curtailed adequately, that it might spill over to another Asian country. And so I think that's the current concern. We think in drug policy of this thing called the balloon. We have a balloon metaphor, and that as you try to squeeze supply in one corner of the balloon, it pops out in another corner of the balloon. But we have to remember that the nuance of that metaphor is not that it pops out on the other side of the balloon. Well, that's obvious, right? A three-year-old would say, oh, if you squeeze it here, it's going to pop out there. But you don't know exactly which part of the other half of the balloon it's going to pop out in. So there's the balloon metaphor includes a surprise element, right? And so if Chinese supply for fentanyl is curtailed and American demand for it picks up or continues, then we don't know where the supply will balloon to.
Could be anywhere when it gets right down to it, someplace with a moderately capable laboratory, away you go. You've got it.
Right, and a lax regulatory environment, yeah.
There you go. Well, the DEA says that 2 out of every 5 pills that contain fentanyl contain deadly amounts of fentanyl. And so when we look at the street and we see people laying in the gutter, and what are we going to do for them?
Well, we're mixing our message here so I want to sort of separate it. And that is, we haven't really talked a lot about the pill problem, right? So
okay.
The majority of fentanyl that's coming to American streets is in powdered form, not pill form. But the pill phenomenon is picking up. And the reason why it's so important to focus on that pill problem is that it's not going to be the person lying in the street who grabs that pill. It's going to be our high school students and our college students and our suburban kids that are going to pick up that pill. Because the reason why we got this whole opioid crisis in the first place is that pills have legitimacy, right? They have this illusion, if you will, of safety. Right, because it came from a doctor, it came from a pharmacist. Well, the truth is, and every American kid needs to hear this now, and young adult needs to hear this now, is that the pills on the street are not to be trusted. We're in a crisis of counterfeit pills that we don't know what's in them. Right, they may look like a Xanax, or they may look like an opioid pill, they may look like a benzodiazepine pill, but they have unknown amounts of fentanyl, they have unknown combinations of an opioid and a benzo. Well, if you wanted to kill someone in an old-fashioned way, for fentanyl crisis, but pre-fentanyl, put an opioid and a benzodiazepine together. That's not a healthy combination. And so those pills are coming from Canada, our neighbor to the north. They're coming from Mexico, our neighbor to the south. And they're coming in unknown quantities, right? If you go to the DEA and say, okay, show me a report, show me data on how many counterfeit pills are coming to the United States. We know how many pounds of cocaine are coming to the United States. We know a tonnage of marijuana that's coming to the United States. But there is no DEA report right now that talks about the number of pills. It's an unknown. And that's because it's new, and they haven't ramped up their surveillance of it enough yet.
And when it gets right down to it, you can probably get like 1 million pills in a suitcase.
Yeah, or, you know, an ample number.
An ample number. I don't know how many.
Right. But again, the risk is magnified by the fact that it's not heroin, right? Because heroin only has a small percentage of people who use it, right? It's a pill, and it's being sold in the clubs, and it's being sold on the college campuses, right? And it's being sold as a Xanax pill. This will help you sleep because you're all stressed out about your exams. Maybe you don't wake up in the morning because it was a sleeper, but it also had fentanyl in it, right? And so that's where fentanyl has all of a sudden become more dangerous, and that is it's a new poisoning epidemic. It's not just poisoning the heroin supply. It's poisoning the illicit pill supply.
So it's the pill. It's a pill, and everybody takes pills. They're in your parents' medicine cabinet, and people take them all the time. So,
and everyone shares pills. They say, you know, oh, you're stressed out because your exam. So here, I take this one. I take it to sleep, you know. And I've had patients who come in and says, I had no idea that this was a bad pill, but you know, I wound up in the ER 3 days ago because I overdosed, right? And they're patients, and they said, well, I ran out of the pills that you prescribed, so I took one of my friends. Like, great. Like, you know, this is the craziness that's going on right now, right? We can't trust that. And they're high-quality pills. So people say, well, I can always tell a bad pill, right? It looks a little funny at the edges, right? These are high-quality pills. And guess where the pill presses are coming from, Michael? You guessed it. China. They're selling $500,000 pill presses to the world community to produce counterfeit pills, and they're going to Mexico, and they're going to our neighbor to the North Canada.
Wow. So you said you saw hope, but...
I'm not presenting a lot of hope, am I? So on the hope side of things, on the hope side of things is that, you know, we're learning from this. There's attention to it. There's money flowing to it. We need, this is a grand opportunity, Michael, a grand opportunity to make a more resilient America, because we've tried the supply side thing. We've done it for 40 years, since more than 40 years, ever since Nixon declared a war on drugs. It's been a war on supply, and it's been a war on black and brown people, right? Well, we're ending the war on black and brown people, hopefully, and we're realizing that the supply side war kind of helps, but it doesn't work as well as we want it to. We're only getting 10 to 15% of the supply, right? If we could get 50%, well, maybe we could brag then, right? Maybe we could say, oh, that's worth the billions of dollars we spend on supply control, right? But 10 to 15%, right? So it's a grand opportunity to look at the demand side. What is it about American culture, whether it's inner city culture that we're talking about, or suburban white culture that we're talking about, or rural culture that we're talking about, that could makes us consume so many drugs, right? And I know that sounds daunting. I know that says, well, you know, that's really hard because, you know, it means cultural change. Well, guess what? That's what this crisis, which means opportunity, right?
Right.
What our crisis brings us to, brings us to the opportunity of cultural change. How do we make our kids more resilient? How do we make our communities, which, as you said, you walk down a lot of communities these days. Now, of course, COVID is beaten us up a lot. But even if you walk down the streets in 2019, right, you saw a lot of communities that are frayed at the edges or frayed at the center, right? We need to rebuild American communities. We need spiritual, economic redevelopment in this country. That will start to address our drug problem. And maybe not for this generation, but what about the next generation? What about the generation after that?
So it seems like you're saying exactly what Nancy Reagan said, which was just say no.
But it's a more complicated version of that, right? The lift yourself up by the bootstraps model of just say no is a moral implication, right? It's a
you're an incomplete
person, and you need to be a better person. What I'm talking about, I didn't say person here. I said society, right? Because a healthier society will make healthier individuals. Yes.
Dr. Daniel Ciccarone, professor of family community medicine, University of California, San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us. Folks, remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you, doctor.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.